Dave Magleby is a consummate faculty member and colleague. He is what we would all like to be. He teaches with distinction. BYU has recognized that by giving him the Carl G. Mazur Award for distinguished teaching. Prior to that, he was named Professor of the Year for the State of Utah by the Carnegie Endowment for the Advancement and Support of Education. And of course, most of us, if not all, recognize that he organized and directs the statewide consortium of colleges and universities which conducts the BYU exit poll, done by students throughout the state, a poll which outperforms all other polls in the state and gives tremendous hands-on experience to dozens of students. He is a diligent citizen of this university and of his profession. He is currently chair of the Department of Political Science and has served on numerous university committees and as a board member and organizing chair of numerous national and regional political science organizations. The most notable recognition of this type of service is yet to be announced this fall. He is a distinguished scholar. And importantly, what he studies, he brings to published fruition. He is the author or co-author of nearly 24 articles and 3 major books in the discipline of political science. His book, The Direct Legislation, was published by Johns Hopkins University Press. The Money Chase was published by the Brookings Institution, and The Myth of the Independent Voter was just published by the University of California Press. In each of these books, he has established himself as a nation's expert on initiative and referenda, on campaign finance, and on voting behavior. He is widely recognized for his abilities, as witnessed by the fact that he was given an APSA, American Political Science Association, Congressional Fellowship to work with the then Majority Leader of the United States Senate, Senator Robert Byrd. The Brookings Institution chose him to do a study of campaign finance reform and was willing to let him do it out of house, something which they had never done. And recently, he was chosen to be co-author of the most widely used American government textbook. His co-authors are the new president of the University of California and the acting president of Colorado College, so you know who's going to do the revisions. He is widely sought after as an expert witness on initiative and referenda, and he was appointed by both the Democratic and Senate leaders, both Democratic and Republican Senate leaders, to a panel to advise Congress on the issues of campaign finance reform. A former faculty member of the University of California at Santa Cruz and the University of Virginia, he has been at BYU since 1981. He was raised across the street from Liberty Park in Salt Lake City and received his BA from the University of Utah and his PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. His wife, Linda, who is with us today, is a practicing attorney in Salt Lake City. One of the nation's most able and distinguished analysts of American elections in the political scene, David B. Magleby will speak to us on elections American style, placing the 1992 elections in perspective.
Thank you for that introduction. Dennis Thompson chaired the search committee that contacted me about a position or a possible job at BYU and persisted in persuading me that I should come to BYU. Professor Thompson has played an important role in my career, and I'm honored with his participation and introduction at today's forum. Thank you, Dennis. I would also like to acknowledge the extraordinary assistance of 4 BYU students, all recent graduates who have been my research assistants on a book that I am now writing and have helped to prepare today's forum address. They are Cami Christiansen, who offered today's invocation, Paul Hansen, who will be running the slides a little later in my lecture, Carl Hewish, who will be offering the benediction, and John Mott, who I think is in the audience. They, like other BYU students, have assisted me in research and teaching and have expanded my horizons and improved my work. Teaching and working with fine students like you is what makes the career of a college teacher so rewarding. I would also like to acknowledge the financial support of the College of Family, Home, and Social Science, which has supported two of the projects that I'll report on today. Data from a third project, the KBYU Utah College's exit poll that Vice President Thompson referred to, has involved hundreds of college students in each of the past five elections. This good work by these students and the willingness of voters to be interviewed by these student interviewers permits me to discuss democracy and voting in Utah, I think, more authoritatively. The commitment of KBYU to public affairs broadcasting and to using their station in part as a training ground for students is commendable. Americans vote more often and for a wider variety of offices than do the citizens of any other democracy. It is not surprising, therefore, that we tend to take voting and elections, these cornerstones of democracy, for granted. In the United States, we are fortunate to have established democratic norms and values, an honest and fairly administered system of election administration, and the tradition of a peaceful transfer of power. Over the past few years, much of the once totalitarian world has embraced democracy. We in the United States, despite the imperfections of our system, have much to offer these new democracies. During this election year, there will be much criticism of our political system, the imperfections of the candidates, the lack of clear policy differences between the major parties, and the negative tone of the campaign. Some of these are problems that deserve serious attention. But what will likely go unnoticed in the flurry of criticism is the great success story of our constitutional democracy. The great success story of our constitutional democracy. A part of our success is the protection of rights and liberties found in the United States Constitution, a document we as Latter-day Saints believe to have been divinely inspired. But when we talk about the Constitution, we often overlook the fact that it established the beginnings of popular rule through regular elections at set times and with fixed terms of office. This is no small accomplishment. To appreciate our tradition of democratic elections, I would like to describe another election in another country. It is the African nation of Liberia, which has been heavily influenced by former slaves from the United States. Most Liberians are descendants of black Africans who came to the country in the 1400s. Only about 1 in 10 Liberians is a descendant of the freed slaves. Yet it was the descendants of those freed American slaves who governed Liberia until 1980, when a group of military officers, identified with the original inhabitants, killed the president and put one of their own, Samuel K. Doe, an army sergeant, in power. Doe was the head of state and chairman of the People's Redemption Council, which promised a return to civilian rule and a new constitution. In 1985, Samuel Doe, under pressure from the United States and other nations, called for a presidential election. Doe himself was a candidate. Because Liberia did not have a democratic tradition, the first step was to agree on an election law. Now, Liberians had no memory about how to conduct an election. Political parties had not been recognized as legal or legitimate. And because there are no street names or numbers, it was difficult to construct a system of voter registration. Finally, because Liberia had no effective postal system, it was difficult to communicate with voters and election officials. Just as important, Liberians lacked experience in casting secret ballots at voting places manned by officials trained in the democratic process. Despite all these limitations, the election was held. Now, some election day actions were taken by Doe which clearly violated Liberia's new election law and the norms of fair elections everywhere. Violations included setting up unauthorized polling places in military barracks, where soldiers friendly to Doe were permitted to cast as many ballots as they wanted. At some rural voting places, illiterate voters were denied the right to cast secret ballots, and soldiers generally intimidated voters at these voting places. The new Liberian election law called for the ballots to be counted at the voting places, and the results then reported to a central office. When Samuel Doe got word that he was trailing his opponent in some voting places, he ordered that all ballot boxes be brought immediately to his palace for accounting by a central committee chosen by him. To no one's surprise, Doe won the election, though the narrow margin by which he declared himself the victor was no doubt hailed by some supporters as a refreshing reform. His opponent and those offended by this violation of democratic procedures had no recourse to the courts, to the police, or an established government that valued democracy. And so, in 1989, a rebellion of Doe's former colleagues led to his assassination and a civil war, which continues to this day. By 1990, the civil war had engulfed the entire country. As many as 13,000 people have died, and half of the nation's 2.5 million people have been displaced. All of these things are consequences of a failed electoral system. The competing factions in the Civil War have agreed now to hold another election this fall, one that hopefully will follow fair and free procedures. Unfortunately, around the world, as nations experiment with democracy, they often have an experience like that of Liberia. The Liberian election teaches us that there are elements of our democracy which we need to more fully appreciate. Let me highlight five. First, fair and uniformly enforced rules. Second, honest counting of ballots. Third, open competition permitted, no police or military interference. Fourth, a free press, the news media able to report on an election in an unfettered manner. And fifth, the peaceful transfer of power to the winner. Each of these elements of constitutional democracy will be part of our 1992 election process. They provide a foundation upon which we have built a working democracy, one that has functioned quite successfully by world standards for more than 200 years. While several other nations also have long-standing democratic traditions, the more typical pattern is for democracy to be short-lived and to be followed by a cycle of tyranny and anarchy. Comparatively few democracies have lasted very long. More than half of the world's constitutions have been written in the past 20 years. One can survey the entire continent of Asia and find no democracy that predates World War II. Even Japan, often considered a strong democracy, has had only one party hold power since the new constitution was written in 1946. The second oldest democracy in Asia is Singapore, a limited democracy since 1959. In Africa, the oldest democracy is Botswana, which has had free elections and a multi-party system since 1966. It's not surprising, given these examples, that the eyes of the world are on the American experiment with democracy. From the 1830s, when Alexis de Tocqueville wrote his classic Democracy in America, until today, we have been correctly identified as an important laboratory for popular rule and constitutional democracy. Today, I would like to take a look at the 1992 American elections. Now, there's some risk in discussing an election that is underway, but I think that the research literature, including some work of my own, provides us with some insights that help put the current election in perspective. What are those insights? First, I will talk about the continuing importance of political parties. Second, the importance of partisanship, candidate appeal, and issues to the voting choice. Third, why third parties and third-party candidates rarely win. And fourth, what explains the high rate of re-election to the U.S. Congress, and will it continue? A noted political scientist wrote 50 years ago that political parties created democracy, and modern democracy is unthinkable save in terms of the parties. The view of parties as central to democracy runs counter to the long-standing anti-party sentiments of Americans. But even the strong anti-party views of several of the founders of our republic moderated as they faced the challenge of making the Constitution work, as they organized to seek office themselves, as they tried to govern. Political parties serve important functions in a democracy. One of the key functions of our two-party system has been to unify the electorate, bringing together groups, sections, and ideologies, and moderating conflicts within the body politic. Parties simplify the choices for the electorate. For the parties, this is a means to gain votes. Another function that parties perform is to provide a loyal opposition. Political parties also organize the competition. They recruit and nominate candidates. They register voters and raise campaign funds. If you doubt my point about the importance of political parties, think about elections without them. My defense of the role of parties is not to say that they are functioning as they should in our democracy. The parties can and should play a more vital role. They need to be more involved in recruiting and training candidates. They can do a better job of structuring the voting choice. But one of the great impediments to their enhanced role is their limited capacity to determine who runs under their party label. In exit poll after exit poll this year, voters have expressed frustration with the choices they have in the presidential primaries, with none of the above placing second or third in several races. But it was the voters in those primaries and not the party leaders who determined the nominees this fall. Enhancing the role of party leaders in the selection process, perhaps along the lines of the Utah system, in which party activists narrow the field of candidates for a subsequent national primary, would not only improve the field of candidates in both parties, but lead to greater voter satisfaction as well. Because our current system is driven by early primaries and intense early media coverage, our electoral cycle is now too long. Potential candidates must make their decisions about running for the White House 2 or more years in advance. It is not surprising that many of the strongest potential Democratic candidates chose not to enter the race. Just 18 months ago, George Bush was mounting an effort to liberate Kuwait and was riding high in presidential popularity polls. By the time that Bush's electoral weaknesses were apparent, a year later, it was too late for more prominent Democratic contenders to enter some primaries, and the field had already been defined by the media. The same systemic constraint could work against Republicans if the Democrats ever win back the White House. Removing the strong party role in the determination of the nominee has enhanced the role of the media in defining and screening politicians. In recent election cycles, the news media have examined in detail the backgrounds and lives of the candidates, some would say excessively. From Gary Hart's activities on the boat Monkey Business to Bill Clinton's Vietnam-era draft status, the press has aggressively pursued background and character of candidates. Now, one argument given by some in the press for this heightened scrutiny is the fact that parties no longer screen candidates on character or electability grounds. Now it is the voters who make those decisions alone, and they need this information in order to make informed choices. Heightened media scrutiny, not only of presidential candidates, but of congressional and state candidates as well, will no doubt discourage good people from running for office. But consider the alternative. Without media scrutiny, how would we know about H. Ross Perot? He is not participating in any normal party process and has sufficient money to craft his own image. In a system as open as ours, the media plays an important role in scrutinizing the character and competence of the candidates. It is part of our national mythology that Americans vote for the person and not the party. Most often, the person we vote for is from our political party. Roughly 87% of Americans since 1952, when political scientists began systematically measuring partisan identification, have some degree of partisan preference. How do we measure partisan identification? By asking the following questions. You can answer to yourselves. Generally speaking, do you usually think of yourself as a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent, or what? If you answered Republican to the first question, we would ask, would you call yourself a strong Republican or a not very strong Republican? And we would repeat that, obviously, for the Democrats. For Independents, we follow up and say, do you think of yourself as closer to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party? Those who say they have a preference, I label Independent leaners. This then leads to seven categories of partisan identification. Strong Democrats, not very strong Democrats, which I'm labeling as weak Democrats, Independent Democrats, those Independents who see themselves as closer to the Democratic Party, pure Independents, those Independents without any partisan leanings, Independent Republicans, weak Republicans, and strong Republicans. Now, the percent answering apolitical, another party like Peace and Freedom, or in California, Bean Sprouts, has not exceeded 2% since 1952. In 1990, the breakdown of party identification nationally and in Utah was, as you see it on the screen. Nationally, the Democrats hold a slight advantage over Republicans if you combine the Independent leaners with their respective parties. In Utah, it is a different story, with Republicans enjoying a more than 2-to-1 advantage, as you can see on the screen. Now, partisan identification is a stable, long-term preference for one political party. In some ways, party choice is like a brand label preference. Most of us do not take long to decide which toothpaste to buy when we're at the supermarket. We have a strong preference for one brand. The preference may be so strong that we do not even consider price in our rush to finish the shopping. Partisan identification is like this. Unless moved by some important element of a campaign, we will vote for the candidate from our party. Strong Republicans have voted about 97% Republican for president on average since 1952, and strong Democrats over 85% on average for the Democrat. Now think about your own vote in the last election. For whom did you vote for county surveyor? I doubt you can tell me the name of that candidate for whom you voted, but you can probably tell me his or her party affiliation. It's the same as your own. Partisan identification is more stable than an individual's ideology, an individual's views on issues, or their preferences for particular candidates. For this reason, political scientists label partisanship as a long-term force compared to the short-term forces of issues and candidates. Partisan identification is often acquired in childhood or adolescence as a result of socialization processes in the family. To illustrate, let me refer you to the example of one of my students participating in my 1980 University of Virginia poll. My students and I were conducting a study of Virginia voters in the 1980 election. The student was interviewing a person from southwestern Virginia. She asked the party identification question. Generally speaking, in politics, do you consider yourself to be a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent, or what? The respondent answered, I don't know. My mother was a Democrat. My father was a Democrat. I guess that must mean I'm a Democrat. The interviewer then asked the follow-up question, are you a strong or a not very strong Democrat? The respondent answered, I'm a strong Democrat. Later in the survey, the interviewer asked, in next month's election, will you be voting for Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter, or John Anderson? The respondent answered, I'll be voting for Ronald Reagan, the Democrat. Now notice that it was easier for this respondent to redefine the party of Ronald Reagan than to change his own partisanship. Party identification provides a lens through which most of us view politics. Generally speaking, the harder information is to get on an election, the more important partisanship will be. Now, the view I am giving you of party runs counter to the popular view that parties are no longer relevant and voters are increasingly independent. In fact, As early as 1974, there were more persons who answered independent to the first party identification question than Republican. This led to widespread speculation that this large and growing block of independents could constitute a new party, could destabilize our two-party system, and if they did not form a new party, at least swing the outcome of elections between the other two major parties. As the numbers of independents continued to grow throughout the 1970s and early 1980s, the speculation about the implications of this trend grew as well. Let me quote from some of that speculation. Kevin Phillips, a noted political theoretician, concluded, quote, "The most enduring phenomenon of the years since the war in Vietnam and Watergate has been the rise in the ranks of independents," close quote. Authors of a book called The Changing American Voter judged the most distinguished contribution to political science in 1976, concluded that, quote, "The most dramatic political change in the American public over the past two decades has been the decline of partisanship," period, close quote. Much of what has been written about independents by the popular press and many political scientists is false, or myth, to use the title of my recent book. Instead of being a large block of voters, more than one-third of the electorate, they are really three groups of voters. First, there are the independent Democrats, who vote heavily Democratic for president, Congress, and other offices. Second, independent Republicans, who are closet Republicans. They vote heavily Republican. The third group, pure independents, who confess no partisan leanings and swing with the short-term electoral tides. They have voted for the winner in every presidential election except two in the last 40 years. But these pure independents hardly fit the description of the ideal citizen, so commonly assumed of independents. Pure independents have the lowest rate of turnout of any category of party identification. To give you some feel for the likely voting patterns of people in 1992, based on 40 years of voting studies, this figure on the screen now presents the average percent vote for the Democratic presidential candidate for each of the categories of party identification. The Utah data are for the 1984 and 1988 elections, and are drawn from the KBYU, Utah College's exit polls, and present precisely the same picture as do the national data. So if you think we're a peculiar state, we're not in this regard. Notice that Utah voters, however, are even more predictably partisan than the national sample. Over 94% of all three types of Republicans have voted Republican in these elections, and roughly 4 out of 5 Democrats have voted Democratic. Yet, voters are not blindly partisan. For example, in his 1990 House candidacy, Bill Orton, a Democrat, garnered 46% of the weak Republican vote, 50% of the independent Republican vote, and 67% of the pure independent vote. Few, however, would use this race as some evidence of some new, powerful national trend based upon Utah voting behavior. The evidence that there are, in fact, three types of independents goes well beyond how independents vote and their rates of turnout. It involves the degree to which they participate in other ways in politics, their sense of personal efficacy, and their knowledge of the political system or current issues. Independent leaners are very different from pure independents. They are, in effect, partisans. And more than two-thirds of all independents confess partisan leanings. What does this mean for 1992? It means that speculation, which you'll be reading a lot about this summer, that the large block of independents will likely be Perot voters, is false. The data from previous years, when we have had independent candidates who claimed the mantle of independence, demonstrate that most independents vote their party rather than vote for independent candidates like George Wallace, John Anderson, or I suspect even H. Ross Perot. Now, how did the independents vote in Utah's 1988 election when independent Merrill Cook was on the ballot? In this chart, I have plotted the vote by categories of partisan identification for Bangor, the Republican, Wilson, the Democrat, and Cook, the independent. Cook's major inroads came among pure independents, and independent-leaning Republicans. Note that independent Democrats, and weak Republicans all gave Cook about 20% of the vote, which was, as you can see, what he received statewide. The important point for today's discussion is that partisanship is alive and well in American elections. Despite what you will read in the popular press, most Americans will come home to their party or to the party they lean towards when they vote this November. The most important factor that explains why Americans sometimes don't vote their party is candidate appeal, or the lack of it. In presidential elections since 1952, voters have viewed Republican candidates for the presidency more positively than they have viewed Democratic candidates. Positive aspects of candidate appeal include experience, leadership, competence, good judgment, and strength. Negative candidate appeal includes the opposite of these attributes listed above, plus aspects like extremism, dishonesty, and lack of knowledge. One way to illustrate candidate appeal is to look at some specific candidates. Dwight Eisenhower is an example of a candidate with positive candidate appeal. Eisenhower's leadership of the Allied effort in World War II made him famous. But not all generals are successful in politics. Look at Douglas MacArthur and Alexander Haig. Rather, it was Eisenhower's unmilitary manner, his moderation, his personal charm, and his lack of a strong party position. He was liked by people in both parties and across the ideological spectrum. Barry Goldwater is an example of a candidate whose campaign reinforced negative images. Goldwater, in his acceptance speech in 1964, said, and I quote, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue," close quote. Lyndon Johnson, Goldwater's opponent, benefited from the public perception that Goldwater was an extremist, out of the mainstream of American politics. This impression was further reinforced when Goldwater's supporters at the convention, Cow Palace in San Francisco, refused for several minutes to let Governor Nelson Rockefeller speak. George McGovern, like Goldwater, is an example of a candidate with negative appeal. His supporters, by dress and manner, also appeared out of the mainstream of American politics. And McGovern became identified with the three A's, acid, amnesty, and abortion. Acid being LSD, or legalized drugs, amnesty applying to draft evaders, and abortion meaning he favored legalized abortion. These three issues, especially taken together, made him an extremist, at least for his time as well. Even more damaging to McGovern was his handling of his chosen vice president, Missouri Senator Tom Eagleton. Less than 2 weeks after Eagleton was nominated, the press reported that he had been hospitalized three times for the treatment of emotional exhaustion and depression. McGovern initially responded that he stood behind Eagleton 1,000%. But as press coverage and criticism of McGovern's lack of investigation into Eagleton's past grew, McGovern dropped Eagleton from the ticket and named a new running mate. To the public, the episode reflected poorly on McGovern's judgment and his ability to stand by his word in the face of opposition. In the end, only about one-third of the public thought McGovern could be trusted as president. Ronald Reagan is an example of positive candidate appeal. In part, he did this by asserting he was better at values like leadership than his opponent, Jimmy Carter. Carter had assumed that Reagan would self-destruct, as had Goldwater, by playing to the more conservative elements of his party. Instead, Reagan decided to reach out to Democrats in his acceptance speech at the 1980 convention. He quoted his favorite president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Hardly a favorite of most Republicans meeting that night at the Joe Louis Arena in Detroit. But Reagan understood that to win the election, he needed to appeal to Democrats as well as Republicans. Reagan then used a visual object. He held his wallet high, and he said, "I am a card-carrying union man." Now, the intent here, again, was to broaden his appeal. Reagan's union, the Screen Actors Guild, is hardly blue-collar. But he had established an identity with working men and women that bore fruit when the votes were counted a few months later. Notice that candidate appeal may have some issue content to it, but is more often based on general assessments of the character, personality, and background of the candidates. Notice also that candidates have different opportunities to define themselves. Traditionally, one of the most important is the National Nominating Convention, when the attention of the nation is focused on the party and its nominee. Candidates understand the importance of this self-definition process and give much attention to it. Candidate appeal is also partly determined by circumstances or the electoral context. The challenger is more likely to be able to be all things to all people, exploiting the incumbent's negatives without offending voters on specifics. Nixon in 1968 ran with a plan to end the Vietnam War, clearly playing to widespread frustration with the ongoing war. But because he was unwilling to give the specifics of his plan, Doves began to think he favored negotiations, and Hawks that he favored a more aggressive military strategy. To an extent, the current popularity of H. Ross Perot is this kind of generalized support for anybody but Bush and Clinton. If Perot can continue to be a safe protest vote, his chances of doing well improve. But if the public learns that he, too, offers a mixed bag, voters are likely to go to the more proven quantities. The battle lines are thus drawn on the critical dimension of candidate definition. George Bush remembers that the defining event of his successful 1988 campaign was his acceptance speech at the Republican convention. Bill Clinton has dropped out of sight for the last several days to choose a running mate, and no doubt to craft his acceptance speech, which he knows will be critical and will be delivered, as you know, next Thursday. And H. Ross Perot, who does not need a convention to be nominated, has announced that he intends to have one anyway. One reason for it will be to focus attention on his strengths and on his agenda. Notice that when we talk about candidate appeal, we do so in terms of positives and negatives. No candidate has only positive or only negative attributes. One of the functions of campaigns is to define the candidates for the voters. When a candidate can both define himself as well as his opponent, as Bush did in 1988, it will not surprise us if that candidate wins. Because candidate appeal is important to the voting calculus, and because negatives can be more important than positives, it is not surprising that campaigns have taken on a negative tone. Many candidates will express revulsion toward the negative nature of our campaigns, only to use more negative advertising in each successive campaign. Now, one consequence of this is, of course, to reinforce the popular stereotype that politicians are not to be trusted, or that they are bad people. I submit that few individuals, if subjected to a political process in which their opponent had every incentive to televise their negative characteristics, would come out as well-liked as they began the process, or perhaps even as well-liked as many of our current politicians. The third component of the voting choice is issues. Issues are typically less important to voters than either partisanship or candidate appeal. Most voters lack the interest or the time to carefully study the issues, learn the positions of the candidates on the most important issues, and then vote accordingly. Sometimes on the most important issues, the positions of the candidates are the same, or in some cases, as with Nixon on Vietnam, there's no explicit position. Not surprisingly, voters tend to cast more generalized issue votes, what some have called retrospective voting. Did the party in power produce peace and prosperity? If yes, then that party's chances of retaining power are improved. Sometimes a single issue can become dominant in an election, as with Vietnam in the late 1960s and early 1970s. But even there, the positions of the parties and candidates are often fuzzy. In 1992, abortion has the potential to be an important issue. But the pro-choice position of H. Ross Perot and the fact that most people see the economy as much more important will likely diminish the role abortion plays in the actual vote choice come November. Third parties are described by some scholars as a response to major party failure. But the crucial aspect about third parties is how often they charge into the national party arena and how they never win. To be sure, they have had a significant indirect influence. They have drawn attention to controversial issues the major parties wish to duck, and they have organized special interest or cause groups, such as the anti-slavery and anti-civil rights movements. They boast, sometimes correctly, that they are champions not of lost causes, but of causes yet to be won. But they have never won the presidency or more than a handful of congressional seats. They have never shaped national policy from inside government, and their influence on national policy in general and on the platforms of the two major parties has been limited. Third parties have taken three forms. One type has been the doctrinal party, such as the small labor or socialist parties on the left and the even smaller conservative movements on the right. The second type is the issue party that arises or splinters from a major party over a particular issue and then dies as the issue is resolved or fades away. The final type of third party, a variation of the issue party, revolves around a particular political personality. The Bull Moose Party of Theodore Roosevelt, which was formally constituted as a progressive party in most states, exemplifies this type of third party. More recently, in 1968, George Wallace's American Independent Party polled over 13 million votes and won 46 electoral votes after he broke with the Democratic Party over desegregation and conservative social issues. In 1980, John Anderson split from the Republican Party, favoring many of its economic stands, but taking liberal positions on social issues. Anderson garnered 6.6% of the national vote, but no electoral votes. In 1992, H. Ross Perot, if he runs, would fit the mode of a party based on a particular personality. The late spring, early summer period that we are now in is the season for third parties to blossom. The major parties have finished their primaries, and there is a hiatus in media coverage before the conventions. Often the public are not yet sure of the likely nominees and therefore are willing to flirt with a third-party vote. But by late summer, after the conventions have reinforced partisanship, after the media have subjected the third-party candidates to the same intense scrutiny they gave the major-party candidates before the Iowa and New Hampshire primaries, after the electoral consequences of our winner-takes-all system are reinforced, third-party candidates wither and fade into a less important role. Now, this last point deserves some explanation. In our system, the winner in each state gets that state's votes in the Electoral College. Voting for a candidate who stands little chance of winning as a form of protest is, so the argument goes, a wasted vote. You are better served by choosing from among the likely winners, where your vote will not be wasted. For this argument to be persuasive, however, the third-party candidate needs to be trailing the major-party candidates in the polls. Otherwise, a third-party candidate can argue that a vote for Clinton or a vote for Bush would be the wasted vote. For this reason, it is strategically important for Perot to maintain his high level of visibility and high ratings in the polls. The normal tendency would be for Perot to begin to fade in the polls in late July or early August. But 1992 may not be a normal year. Neither party has a nominee with a substantial core of strong supporters. Public frustration with the political system is high and may continue to foster a throw-the-bums-out mentality. And finally, Perot has indicated that he is willing to spend as much as $100 million of his own money. All this makes for a very interesting summer and fall election period. Utah's experience with a serious third-party candidacy for governor in 1988 helps us understand some of the campaign dynamics of 1992. Merrill Cook's independent campaign ended up with 20% of the vote, a historic high for contests for Utah governor. But Cook, like Perot in 1992, changed the campaign assumptions of both Democrat Ted Wilson and Republican Norm Bangerter. They did not know whether to run against each other or against Cook, or to hold back and let the other two fight it out. Bush is demonstrating some of these tendencies in his campaign now. Does he move to the right, toward more conservative positions to try to diminish the appeal of Perot among conservatives, but leave the center to Clinton? Or does he go after Clinton and try and ignore Perot? Clinton, on the other hand, has to decide whether to embrace the I am an outsider theme that is part of Perot's success, or the I can work within the system theme that places him much closer to Bush. Because serious third-party challenges are so rare in American politics, both major party candidates are sailing mostly uncharted waters here. It is unlikely that Perot can win the presidential election. But what is clear is that he has infused interest and life into what was otherwise bound to continue our trend of declining voter turnout. Stay tuned for a different and interesting fall campaign. This year is a campaign full of anomalies, a few of which might get elected. As I pointed out earlier, the United States structures elections as distinct choices that permit voters to elect a Republican for president and a Democrat to the U.S. House, which is exactly what we have done collectively for 18 of the last 22 years. This has resulted in divided government, in which the Republicans have been the dominant presidential party and the Democrats the dominant congressional party. Divided party control of government arguably exaggerates the tendency for deadlock and delay already built into our system as a result of the separation of powers and checks and balances. In fact, during periods when the Democrats have controlled both branches, there was plenty of institutional squabbling. But the persistence of divided government in the U.S. raises the question of why. One explanation preferred by Democrats is that they run the best candidates for the House and the Senate, that they have a broader base of electoral support at the state and local levels, and that the public is happy with their performance. Republicans counter that the public would really prefer Republicans to be the majority party in Congress, but that the advantages of incumbency, the partisan mischief of gerrymandering by Democrats in many state legislatures, and the ability of Democrats to raise lots of campaign money are what has kept the Democrats in control of the Congress. Putting partisan rhetoric aside, it is clear that the public likes the senators and representatives. Voters reelected over 95% of House incumbents in the past five elections. Senators have a somewhat lower reelection rate, but still are reelected about 88% of the time since 1982. Charges of a permanent Congress surfaced after the 1980 election, but have dissipated in 1992 because at least 84 House or Senate members are not seeking reelection to the House or have been defeated in primaries for renomination. But the structural advantages of incumbency remain, and they deserve careful attention. One of those, a principal cause of the high reelection rate, is the fundraising advantage enjoyed by incumbents. Aside from candidates with substantial amounts of their own money to spend on campaigns, which Utah seems to have plenty of this year, incumbents can and do generally outspend challengers. One reason for this is their ability to raise what I have called interested money. A primary source of interested money is political action committees, or PACs. As the figure now on the screen shows you, PACs have given over 80% of their contributions in 1990 to incumbents. Early data for 1992 shows an even higher percentage. Individual contributors are much more likely to bet on incumbents when making their contributions as well. Only the political parties are willing to invest in challengers. Another development in congressional campaigns worth noting is the nationalization of U.S. Senate elections, especially in less populated states. Part of the reason for this recent trend is the closeness of the party balance in the 1980s. Republicans actually won a majority in 1980, only to see the Democrats regain the majority in the Senate again in 1986. This very competitive situation has made winning as many seats as possible a high priority for both parties and for interest groups. Let me illustrate with a recent example. A record high of over $14.50 was spent on each person of voting age in South Dakota's 1986 U.S. Senate election. That's a lot of money. For Utah to reach this record, we would need a total for Senate spending this year in excess of $16 million. Now, it's doubtful that we will reach this record. However, given the high rate of spending at the recent Republican convention, it is possible. Utah's surrounding states, all small in population, have also seen a surge in spending in U.S. Senate elections. Idaho, Nevada, and Colorado all have had high-cost elections in recent years and will again in 1992. But Utah has not been part of this trend because the Democrats have not run serious challengers. This has already changed for 1992, and Utah will become part of the pattern for disproportionately high spending in U.S. Senate elections. Now, when these Senate candidates in small states raise large sums of money, they must often do so out of state. North Dakota Senator Quinton Burdick raised more than 99% of his large individual contributions outside of North Dakota. And Utah's Orrin Hatch was not far behind, raising more than 95% of his large individual contributions outside of Utah. When candidates like these raise this amount of out-of-state money flowing into strategically important Senate elections, it raises questions of whom the senator or representative represents, those who fund the campaigns, or those who vote on election day. No one really believes that elections will replace baseball as our national pastime. But it is true that campaigns and elections are central to our democracy and will occupy an important part of the attention of many voters between now and November 2nd. While much about 1992 will be new or different, there are some important perspectives which past elections provide. Our political parties, while organizationally weak and beset with problems, remain central to the operation of our electoral system. Voters base their voting choice on three primary factors: their partisanship, the relative appeal of the competing candidates, and highly salient issues. While H. Ross Perot has generated considerable attention this spring and early summer, he likely will fade by Election Day. Finally, while 1992 to date has been the worst year in more than 50 for congressional incumbents, at least 84 have decided to retire, run for another office, or have already lost in the primaries. The structural advantages of incumbency remain, and there is no sign that they have lost their substantial fundraising advantage. Reinhold Niebuhr has said that democracy consists of ways of finding approximate solutions to insoluble problems. He adds that while man's capacity for good makes democracy possible, his tendency for evil makes it essential. Elections that meet the standards I have discussed today are essential to the foundation of a successful democracy. While there is room to improve our electoral system, the more important point is that to a remarkable extent it works and has served us well. Thank you for the opportunity to deliver today's forum address.